Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
I'm so excited to tell you a bit about today's sponsor, Music Masters Collective. They're a nonprofit organization that produces unique music events, providing opportunities for fans and artists to meet and collaborate in an inspired and creative atmosphere. Every week, Music Masters Collective hosts different events, all with the opportunity to learn from world-class musicians like Bill Frisell, Kurt Rosenwinkel, Julian Lage, Mark Ribot, Wayne Krantz, Oteil Burbridge, the Milk Carton Kids, and so many more. At an event like Alternative Guitar Summit Camp happening this August, you can expect in-depth workshops with guitar masters, once-in-a-lifetime performances, the opportunity to play alongside your favorite musicians, and a lot of fun. You'll leave this event packed full of wisdom and with a whole community of musicians to create with. This all-inclusive week in the Catskills Mountains of upstate New York is guaranteed to be magical. Scholarships are available, but spots are extremely limited, so visit www.alternativeguitarsummitcamp.com/inside to learn more. Hey everyone, and welcome to Inside the Musician's Brain. I'm your host, Chris Pandolfi from the infamous String Dusters, and this is episode 10. This is actually going to be the final episode in the first season of the podcast, and I want to say a heartfelt thanks to everyone who's tuned in so far, and also to all my amazing guests this first season for sharing so much personal insight into how you all do what you do. It's been a great learning experience for everyone who's had the chance to listen, and absolutely for me as well. So thank you all. In this episode, I'm going to do a little wrap-up of this first season and also a preview of season two and all the cool things that we've got on tap. After that, I'm going to give you my picks for the top duster shows of the year so far from our first two legs of tour so that you can head over to Nugs and check those out. And then I've got a full-length interview with Tom Hamilton. You might know him from Joe Russo's Almost Dead, a.k.a. J-Rad, or Ghostlight, or possibly American Babies. He's a prolific and super interesting guy with tons of stuff to say about producing, songwriting, starting a band, and all kinds of other great stuff. So stick around for that. Quick note that Inside the Musician's Brain is brought to you by Osiris Media. Osiris is home to all kinds of great music-based podcasts, but there's a lot of great new and interesting stuff going on over there at Osiris, including Jam Just Happened. They've had one installment so far. This is a live event in front of a live audience, ticketed show that you can go check out in person or after the fact. The first one was hosted by Scott Metzger, improvised music with all kinds of great musicians, so check that out. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by EMG. You guys might know them as maker of high-quality pickups for all kinds of different instruments, and they are making a great banjo pickup right now. They're actually making two. The one I'm using is called the ACB Barrel, and it just really sounds great, feels great in a live environment. You know, it's hard to amplify the banjo, but Rob Turner over at EMG has come up with a great design, really reliable, literally never had a problem with this pickup over hundreds of shows, easy to install, and EMG is just a really cool company, all made in the USA, family owned and operated since 1976. I loved getting to know these guys and work with them as well. If you have any pickup needs, acoustic or electric, EMG is where it's at, so check them out. Crazy to think that this is the last episode in the first season of the podcast. No one tells you how many episodes comprise a season, but for me, the number is 10, and that is primarily because trying to put this thing together while the Dusters are heavy on tour in the first 4 months of the year has been a real challenge. Living week to week, grabbing interviews while I'm on the road, getting home, trying to edit them down, put these intros together. It's been a lot of work. Really something that I enjoy, but basically right now I'm going to hit pause, most likely come back I think sometime in May when the String Duster schedule kind of shifts more into festival summer mode and I'm only gone mostly on the weekends. And in the meantime, I'm going to bank interviews with some amazing guests and also try to just scheme up new and different things that we can do here on the pod. And I'd love to hear from you guys anything, questions that you'd love to hear these guests tackle, questions about the String Dusters world. Of course, I'm going to keep digging into that as we go and let you guys know how we do our thing. Best places to check in with me are on Instagram. You can follow me, TradPlus, TradPlus. Shoot me a message there or leave a comment on any of the Inside the Musician's Brain related posts. And another great place to engage is on the String Dusters fan page on Facebook called Got Dusted. I'll be putting posts up there occasionally asking you guys what you're into. So hit me back and let me know. And shameless plug right here, if you can go to Apple Podcasts and leave me a review, let the world know why we need more Inside the Musician's Brain. That would be huge. If you're digging the guests that I've had so far here in season one, I just went live with a playlist over on Spotify called Inside the Musician's Brain that has all kinds of great picks from all these great artists, including a lot of the music that we've discussed here on the podcast. So check that out, tune in there. And I've actually got a few other playlists that I'm cooking up right now, getting into some music discovery for season two, trying to hip you guys to new young artists, acoustic and otherwise, and I'll be sharing those as the pod rolls along and also breaking down what these artists are all about. I've got a new mobile rig, so I'm going to be out doing like a festival coverage thing, grabbing short interviews with artists there, getting their perspectives on music and life and everything in between. I'm going to try and write some music live in the intros, maybe solo, maybe with some of my Duster bros, and take you guys inside that process a step further. Hopefully releasing some new music here as well. I've got a new Trad Plus album that's about ready to go, so I'm going to try and drop some of that stuff here on the podcast. You can check out my first album. It's already up on Spotify, Trad Plus. The album is called Interference. It's banjo melodies along with beats and analog synths, strings, electronic elements, ambient vibes. Oteil Burbridge plays bass on one track, and there's lots more where that came from. The theme song, actually, to the podcast is one of those new Trad Plus tracks, the song that plays at the beginning and the end. So we got that to look forward to, as well as advice for young bands, breakdowns of studio gear, live gear, instruments, all kinds of good stuff coming your way in season two. Again, hit me with your questions, hit me with a review, and we'll keep this train rolling. All right, before we get to my interview with Tom, I want to get you guys some picks for my top shows of the year so far. We've been out on two legs of tour, one in January, one in February, and in my opinion, we've had really some of our best shows ever, and that's the way it should be for a band that hopefully is continuing to push the envelope as we are certainly trying to do. And that's not only for ourselves, but also for our fans, just keeping things fresh and mixing it up as we go along. So what does that mean to push the envelope in terms of String Duster shows? Well, for us, it means more new music, more deep cuts, bringing back stuff from the past, taking songs that have been in the rotation for a while and mixing it up with those. So like adding jams or changing the arrangements, you know, we're all evolving as musicians, we're evolving as a band. And sometimes we find new and different, cooler ways to kind of bring these songs to life. And all these things come together via new kind of conceptual set lists. So lots of new transitional elements. And then we've also got some shows, including some of my top picks that I'm about to hit you with here in a second, that have reoccurring teases throughout the show, or songs that start and then segue into a bunch of other music before returning to that song. Again, deep cuts, bust outs, all that good stuff. And the fun thing, the really engaging thing about continuing to push the envelope for us as musicians, and I know that this has been a theme throughout these first 10 episodes, is that it really requires you to stay present in the moment and stay present with the music. And that, of course, is a lesson that extends far outside of music. But if you can just be there on the ragged edge, listening, paying attention, not focusing just on what you're playing as an individual, but really getting that big picture, that perspective about what's happening with the whole, what's happening with the band, where is everyone trying to go? How can I be a part of that journey? How can I lend my voice to make the whole sound elevated and have the whole show come to life, band, audience together, that whole amazing thing? And if you want to check these shows out, just head over to nugs.com, search the String Dusters. Thanks to our amazing audio team, Drew Becker and Carol Miller. Everything's up there at Nugs. And shout out to our whole amazing crew, Tony Hume, our tour manager, Tracy, our merch guru, Jason on the lights, again, Drew, Carol, and our beloved bus driver, Wynn. Thank you guys so much for what you do. All right, so from the first leg, I've got to go with San Francisco. That show was where we had all those shakedown teases and then ultimately busted out a great shakedown toward the end of the show, automatic dance party in the house that the Grateful Dead built. That was an awesome one. And then LA on the last night of tour, the sleeper show. We've had some great shows in LA. We're at the Terragram Ballroom for the first time. We had a bunch of shows at the Troubadour leading up to this, and the place was electric. Like, you could just feel that energy coming from the crowd right up on stage. We were doing everything we could to give it back. That show really came to life. So San Fran and LA from the first leg. And on the second leg of tour, and there were a lot of great shows, but I remember in Mini, we had an Echoes of Goodbye, I believe, and the first set where we added a jam. That song has always been just a tight, like 3 minutes, just super fast bluegrass song that Jeremy wrote. And we added this jam that really elevated things toward the end. Andy Hall kind of takes the lead on that. And then Athens, that would be my last pick. The Georgia Theater, we had all those Pink Floyd teases. And then, of course, we had the Rapper's Delight, where yours truly threw down the first part of the verse and then handed it off to my man Tony Hume, our tour manager, who just crushed it in the Michael Jordan jersey, no less. That was awesome. So, couple picks for you from the first leg of tour. I'm actually about to head out to tour tomorrow night. This episode will air on March 10th, but just getting things done before I'm back on the road. We've got two more legs of tour to go. I'll make sure to hit you guys with my picks from those shows. But right now, I want to jump ahead to my interview with Tom Hamilton. Tom was actually the first guest that I've interviewed who I hadn't really hung with before we sat down to do this interview. He had a lot of really interesting things to say about producing music, the Ghostlight Project and how that came together, and then the story of J-Rad, which I was so curious to dig into. Like, how did this band come to be such a juggernaut? So here we go, Tom Hamilton. This is Inside the Musician's Brain, episode 10, coming to you from downtown Denver. And my guest today is an incredible singer, songwriter, guitar player, producer, and probably one of the most prolific cats I've encountered on our scene, Tom Hamilton. Great to meet you, brother.
A pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely, man. This is great. Glad you could do this. Ghostlight, of course, is at the Ogden tonight.
Yeah.
And hoping to make that show. I definitely got deep into your guys' stuff, like I was saying when I interviewed Holly. Great. That first record is just killer, man. Great work on all that.
Thank you, man.
Yeah. Now, you're a dude who's got a lot going on.
Quite a few irons in the fire.
And seems like you're really making it work. How do you keep all that in balance? You know, what are your priorities? I know you've got, you know, a few different projects that are really active, especially Ghostlight and J-Rad. Producing, you've got your new studio in Philly. Like, how do you make all this stuff work?
You know, I don't. It's kind of the problem. I don't believe in balance.
What does that mean?
The idea that I'm supposed to have like a regular life, you know?
Yep.
If I wanted that, I would have been a fucking accountant.
Gotcha.
You know, like that's not the way, that's not the point. I think you're supposed to run yourself fucking ragged. I think you're supposed to stretch yourself out and push yourself and, in theory, your coworkers and your fan base and everybody just keep pushing and trying to do more, and not so much as in quantity, but as in quality. So I don't do balance. I work until I have a fucking nervous breakdown. And then I grow a beard like this and sit in my house for a month, and then I lick my wounds and start it over again.
Well, you know? The beard looks good, by the way. and the music sounds great, man. I gotta say, this is actually, of all the guests I've had on the podcast, you're the first one who I've never actually really hung with. So, you know, glad to meet you for one thing, but I also got a chance to really check out your music, man. There's just so much cool stuff there. And, you know, like I was saying, the Ghostlight record, the production on that thing is amazing. And I'm curious to know, like, as far as your influences, you know, the people that you're checking out, because I know it's probably pretty eclectic. I hear a lot of great elements of, you know, rock, hooks, songwriting, but then there's this real strong component of production, you know, these cool ethereal vibes, and of course everything sort of sewed together to bring these songs to life in a really seemingly deliberate way. What kind of stuff are you into? Like, what are your main influences?
Well, you know, as far as production goes, I think my favorite producer is Jimmy Page. Like, I think the Led Zeppelin stuff is some of the, you know, I think that band and him particularly are very underrated as far as like their studio sounds, their production, that, you know, like the sound of fucking Houses of the Holy.
Oh yeah.
Or, you know, I mean, that it's incredible. Yep. It's fucking incredible.
And
that's all Jimmy Page, man. Like, yep, you know, he did all that stuff. And, so, you know, he's a huge, huge influence on, you know, just the, I don't know, the taking virtuosity and making it have taste, you know?
Yeah.
You can, especially now it's very prevalent. You could take five of the biggest swing and dick players and what are they going to, you know, they can shred and do and like rip cool shit, but they're not going to write a song that's worth anything. You know, they're not going to write Cashmere, you know? They're not gonna,
amen. Yeah.
You know? And like, and I think that there's been continually been a disconnect between ability and what you do with that ability, you know, and you know, you could be the greatest guitar player in the world and I don't give a fuck. That means nothing to me.
Yep.
If you can't write a song.
Yeah.
You know, like it's not, you know, like Hendrix, I grew up listening to Hendrix, but it never dawned on me until I was well into my 20s that like to look at him as a guitar player, you know, like, it was really always like, dude, listen to Axis Bold as Love. That record, the production on that shit is sideways. Fucking insane. It's insanity what's going on in those records.
So what about like some more current day stuff that you're into?
Production wise, or just in general?
Anything. You know?
I mean, right now I'm like super into, there's this band called Big Thief that's like the most crushing, like, just like knife in the chest, you know, type of just beautiful songwriting. The main songwriter, I don't know her name actually. I'm embarrassed to say, but it's just like, I don't know.
What's the vibe? Like what's the music like?
It's soft and minimalist.
Okay.
You know, but she is an incredible songwriter that feels on a level that, like, you know, that is very uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable how vulnerable she is.
Yeah.
Which is like, you know, that's like the most attractive shit to me, you know?
Big Thief.
Yeah. But like the band, you know, like the rhythm section, has like a sloppiness to it that is really interesting to me. It's like almost like, I shudder to say, like the Dead, you know, like there's just such a looseness to what's going on, you know, but I mean, they don't jam, but I'm so like the,
but the music's not polished to a point where the vibe is sort of sucked out of it.
There's a thing where it feels like it could fall apart at any moment type of thing, which I really love.
Yeah.
You know? Like, ever listen to Bonnie Prince Billy?
Oh, yeah.
Man, he has a record called Ease Down the Road, which is, like, I think one of the best records ever made. And you can hear that, like, he, you know, it was Steve Albini produced it. And I don't know if it was Albini or if it was Will Oldham who did the Dylan thing with it. It was like, you know, he got a bunch of people in a room, played them the song once, and then hit record.
Yep.
You know, it was like, all right, here we go. So you it's all teetering on the edge of fucking just disaster. and there's a fucking beauty to that. You know, there's like this people taking extra care, listening extra hard because they don't know what's happening next, you know, and it doesn't say there's no polishedness to it. There's no like, this is my, hey, hold on, man, I'm going to come with my part. You know what I mean? Like, fuck you and your part. Like, what's happening in a moment, you know?
That's right. That really speaks to, you know, I think producing is a very like case by case thing, obviously.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But if there's one thing that you need across the board, you know, and this is obviously probably just music in general, it's just to be present in the moment with
willing present participants is usually the, you know, the fucking X factor.
There, I like it.
Know?
Yeah.
And again, that's just, this is all personal taste, you know, I mean, like obviously there's the, you know, and I've gone through it. I've done it, like the, you know, the, like the Sgt. Pepper idea of like, you know, you can just kind of, or a Beach Boy thing. It. Well, yeah. And just like, just doing it, everything bit by bit, you know, like, I have an American Babies record, the second one, Flawed Logic. And it's like, most of the record is that it's like everything was done in pieces. Like maybe if, you know, I mean, a lot of it I play drums on, but like if there are other drummers, it was probably tracked as like just guitar and drums or maybe the trio of, you know, with a bass. And then everything else is just, you know, piled on.
Yeah. Like it's and for those of you guys who don't know, you know, just for a little context, and I love the story of Sgt. Pepper's, you know, as the Beatles had just come to the end of, and not, I don't know if many people know this, but only toured for 6 years.
Yep.
And then they go in and they make Sgt. Pepper's.
License to Kill.
Dude. And it was like their sort of rebellion against the touring thing, which, you know, the reality for them was that technology of playing these big stadiums and PAs, it wasn't there and they weren't into it. And they go in and they make Sgt. Pepper's, you know, hailed as one of the greatest records of all time, that really sort of brought this concept of the studio as an instrument
100%, yeah,
to life. And, you know, it's amazing because everything falls on this spectrum. You know, I had Dave Simonette from Trampled by Turtles on the last episode, and he's very raw songwriter. They go in, learn the tune on the spot, boom, 2-3 takes, done.
Yeah, great.
And again, present with the music is what brings it to life, but there's all manner. At the other end of the spectrum, there's this idea that in the studio these days,
you can go fucking
anything
nuts,
is possible.
And, you know, so I feel like my personal thing, you know, when I first got into production, I was way into that idea, the Beatle thing, and like the, and just creating, and I still am to an extent. I mean, the Ghostlight record is not a reproducible thing in certain aspects. You know?
Did you guys do a lot of layering when you were in the studio for that?
We did the five of us in a room. Just set up in a circle in at Rittenhouse, the place you guys were.
Yeah, sure. In Philly.
We set up in a circle and tracked everything live. And then went back and did the like bells and whistles shit. We did the, we had the horn section come in. We have a percussionist come in and just do all the crazy, like, you know, like Keep Your Hands to Yourself has all those like awesome percussion tracks in there. It's like a fucking Michael Jackson track or something.
Yeah.
You know? So, you know, we did do some things there, but that was like a, there was a vision behind that, like before we even started, you know, recording, of like, it was like, you know, I got super back into like grunge music. I was like really killing, like, you know, Soundgarden and Pearl Jam and a lot of Alice in Chains. And I wanted to make a record like that, that wasn't reliant on a distorted guitar. You know, I was like, okay, well, what if you take, a Soundgarden record and you make Sufjan Stevens play it. That was the idea.
I'd love to find out.
Well, that's kind of what the Ghostlight record is supposed to be, you know?
Cool.
So you have all these like riffs, these heavy riffs and cool like things happening. But instead of it being like these like fuzzed out guitars, it's a fucking clarinet and a flute.
Sure.
You know, playing lines or, you know, like whatever, you know, instead of like a ripping guitar solo, there's just a fucking baritone sax. It sounds like it's falling down the steps.
The textures on that record are so lush.
Yeah.
And there's tracks that, the first one, Elegy.
Yeah.
And then I love that track, Isosceles.
Yeah, that's my favorite one on that.
Oh, man.
Talked for hours. She told me everything I needed to hear. We went for pleasure. The aftermath keeps spilling out in the mirror.
What a great track.
It's a moody number.
It's a moody number, but it's I think it, like you were just saying, you know, it's like there's an edge to it. Obviously, the music has all this presence and the great writing, but there's an edge to it, but it's like a soft edge, kind of. It's like,
sure.
You know, it's got just this really, it's like production 101, man. You killed it on that
Thank
stuff.
You.
Yeah, really dig
you
it.
You know, so back to what we were going with, which was like, so when I started out, I was way more into like the Beatle thing and this and like that idea. But that was also fucking 2002, you know, or something when I started doing this shit, which was the beginning of like readily available digital recording.
Mm-hmm.
It's like all of a sudden you have 96 tracks, which is basically unlimited tracks,
sure,
to do whatever you want, you know, whereas in the Beatles had four, you know.
So they were going back over tape.
Ping-ponging and doing the thing. So, you know, so I got way into like the whole idea of producing like that. And so my first band, Brothers Past, we were like, you know, one of those like for super early bands doing the electronic thing, right? So we made a couple records and I like cut my teeth on the production with that, and it was just a lot of overdubs and all that shit. And then the American Baby stuff, as you heard, is what it is. But, you know, I feel like there's a difference between using the studio as an instrument and using it as a crutch. You can just fake it.
You can fix it.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, I mean, everything is just fixable.
Right.
And you know, and pristine and to a, you know, and like perfect. There's perfection in music, which is like, what the fuck is that? You know, like why is there a click track? Why is that a thing?
That's
not, you know, that doesn't do anything for anybody. Like making shit sterile, you know? Bands don't have to be bands. They don't have to be good.
Right.
They don't have, you know, like the Beatles went in and made their first record in a day.
Yeah.
Just went in and played it and sung it live. That was it. You know, like you were either good or you weren't, you know, and that doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah. No, I hear that because, you know, in bluegrass, which is sort of definitely our native territory, perfection is a thing. You know, and playing clean and perfect and no mistakes. And I'm always encountering that, you know, when I'm producing like up and coming string bands, they think that recording in the studio is supposed to be this thing that's like different and better than when they play live. And I'm always like, no, you know, you got to have some perspective on the fact that the things that people are going to connect to in your music are often things that you get distracted from and don't see when you start to get focused on this, perfection idea.
Yeah.
And then of course, with the way that the studio is these days, that further sort of tricks you and pushes you down that road, and you get distracted from doing the thing that's really going to connect with people, which is just all that experience you have playing as a band, that sound, that, you know,
that thing. So, a buddy of mine, he does a lot of live, mixing, right? As far as like live records, it's like a specialty.
From the gas pump to the grocery store, inflation is everywhere. Seriously, make it stop. Thankfully, there's one company out there that's giving you a much needed break. It's Mint Mobile. As the first company to sell premium wireless service online only, Mint Mobile lets you order from home and save a ton with phone plans starting at just $15 a month. All plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed data delivered on the nation's largest 5G network.
To get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month and get the plan shipped to your door for free, go to mintmobile.com/switch. That's mintmobile.com/switch.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
What is a city without its music?
The legacy of the New York Philharmonic
is incredible. Nearly two centuries of history. That's a lot of music and a lot of stories.
I was sitting on stage for the very first time thinking, I can't quite believe this is happening.
Join me, Jamie Bernstein, as we explore the history of the New York Philharmonic. It's the NY Phil Story Made in New York, a podcast about a city, its people, and their orchestra. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
He did Fish for years. He currently does Bruce Springsteen.
Who's that?
His name's John Altshuler.
Okay, cool.
He's like my mentor. He's who taught me how to be a producer and an engineer. Every record I've done since probably 2005, he's done something on it. Whether it was he mixed it or he recorded it or he mastered something. He's like my guy. He does Springsteen, right? I was in a studio and he's got a show pulled up that he was mixing, and I start soloing things. Soloing the guitars, soloing the drums. It's a fucking nightmare. The band sound, it's a fucking nightmare. They're terrible. They're terrible when you listen to them on their own.
Right.
You're like, this is dog shit. And then when you just let it go and you listen to the band, you're like, oh no, never mind. That's Bruce fucking Springsteen in the E Street Band.
Yeah.
You know, like it's the whole, that's the thing that
that's
matters.
Right. That's right.
You know, the fact that, or the Stones is a great example of that. You know, the fact that, you know, one dude's pushing, another guy's pulling, you know, Charlie Watts is just back there holding it fucking down. You know, like the sloppiness is what makes it awesome. There's a perfection is, it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
You know, so why would you make that a thing? And you know, I don't know. I feel like the records that last forever, like the things that are 50 years old, that still people are still listening to fucking Sgt. Pepper.
Amen.
or fucking Dark Side of the Moon, you know, all those Zeppelin albums. Dude, you listen to Led Zeppelin, it's like those records are shit shows. You know, like, since I've been loving you, you could hear the fucking squeak of the kick pedal,
right?
Or like, you know, the John Paul Jones fucks up the bass, and they kept it because it's not about perfection. It's about performance. It's about that. Is that the take that when you listen to it, it makes every nerve ending in your fucking body feel like it's on fire?
Right.
That's what you're going to remember.
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing that's going to last for as long as we're a civilization. You know, people aren't going to remember perfection. Who the fuck cares about that? You know.
So what do you feel like? I love all of this and couldn't agree more. How do you feel like when you're producing and you're working with bands? Like, what's the ticket to getting people in that zone?
Oh man, I don't even really know. I don't know, man. I communication, I think, is like or at least, you know, making the Ghostlight record, I think, you know, a lot of it was communication. And earning trust, you know, I mean, that's the thing, right? When you're producing somebody, they have to trust you.
Yeah.
If not,
what's
the point? You know, I produced a band, I did this record, and it was like, you know, I won't go into who it was, but it was like, it was definitely like a very intense social situation as far as just like the band, like their inner workings, you know, a lot of ego stroking, gotta fucking, you know, whack off a bunch of dudes' fucking brains just so like they feel like they're important, you know, type of thing, which is like, fuck, who wants to deal with this, you know?
Because that's kind of the opposite of everything you just said.
Right, exactly. You know, and like and getting people like that to trust you is impossible because everybody thinks they're the smartest guy in the room.
And to trust your judgment about their music.
Right.
Well, this thing that they is their baby.
It's like, hey, you hired me.
Right.
I'm going to tell you what the deal is. If you'd want to listen to it, cool. And if you don't, that's also fine. It's your fucking song. It's your album. It's your whatever. But like, that's why I like, I mean, yeah, I'm not that super stoked on producing people that aren't my own bands anymore.
Yeah.
It's just like, well, don't hire me and bring me in and then not listen to me. What's the fucking point?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you know, I'm always down for like, hey, let's talk about it or whatever. But like, you know,
and in terms of trusting you, just like your judgment, this is the take,
right?
This thing is,
yeah,
is good.
Trust me, this is fucking great.
Right. You know? Because they're getting more focused on that perfection.
Yeah. And they're all them, just themselves.
Yeah.
You know?
It's like, sure. Not the whole.
Yeah, man. Ego is a fucking rough thing. You know,
music's got a lot though. Got a lot of,
yeah,
that.
And it's just, it sucks. You know, I mean, man, the best thing that ever fucking happened to me, my first band was this band called Brothers Pass. And we were like, I started it like right out of high school. We were all a bunch of kids. And this is late 90s, you know. So it was like, we're super into the Dead and the Allman Brothers and Fish and like, you know, all the hot shit that's going on at the time. And then I found a band called Stereolab. Ever hear Stereolab?
I have, yeah.
I fucking love that band.
Cool.
They're like one of my all time favorite bands. And it blew my fucking mind. The idea that you can incorporate electronic music into pop music was like,
sure.
And I don't mean that as in like dance pop music, but as in like great songwriting, but also like incorporating like drum and bass, you know,
sure,
what I mean?
Sure.
Like,
yep.
Or like house, like deep house shit, or like, you know, like this stuff that was like the underground electronic stuff. And then taking that and applying it to songwriting, it really fucked me up. And then so then we got super into the idea of electronic music and how to incorporate that into what we were doing. And then, you know, and then it turned, and then there was a, at the time there's a bunch of other bands doing it, you know, like that's when we met the Disco Biscuits. Those guys, you know, were doing the same thing but with like electronic music, but combining it with like classical, like prog and like whatever, you know. And then like
compositional stuff.
Exactly.
You produced a record for those guys.
I did yeah. A couple of records with those guys.
Okay,
and
cool.
Yeah, they're great, you know, very good friends. I'm very fortunate to know those dudes. But like Lake Trout was a band. You remember that band?
Sure, yeah.
Fuck, there was, I don't think there was a better band in the scene still than Lake Trout. I think they were the best fucking thing going. You know, like that drum and bass stuff, but mixed with like, you know, fucking Radiohead songwriting, you know. So there was a lot of kindred spirits out there doing the same shit, you know. But what happens when you're a fucking guitar player and you're starting to like try to play house music or drum and bass shit, there's no guitar. There's no fucking guitar. And if there is, it's certainly not playing a fucking guitar solo.
Yeah.
You know, it's a part of the whole.
Yep.
If what's more important, stroking your own shit or making the band and the vision the best it can be, you know? And it, you know, it takes a second to knock your 20-year-old ego down the steps a couple times so it doesn't get back up. And then I had to like learn how to be not the dude, you know? And it's a tough pill to swallow as a guitar player.
And what do you mean by that? You mean just accepting this idea that, you know, your vision is more about the whole and coming into that. Yeah.
It's not about you. It's not about you. It's not fucking about you. Don't make it about you. Stop thinking about your fucking self.
Yeah.
10 goddamn minutes and think about the band and the sound and the finished product.
Yeah.
What is the most important thing that you're going for here?
Yeah.
To make it so people think you're a great guitar player, or to make a piece of art that is going to fucking last and that's going to say something to somebody.
And that extends even beyond music, you know, that's,
oh, for sure.
And
100%.
Grateful Dead come right to mind, you know, I mean, talk about the sound of the whole, you know, it's like,
yeah. For sure. You know, like, yeah. I mean, that's a different thing, I think, because that is, you know, five to six dudes with ego that are like, we're all going to say it
Interesting. You know? Okay. Okay, cool. Yeah.
Like, you know, like when you listen to that shit, you know, like there's nobody's sinking into a background there. You know, like everyone's a lead instrument in that band.
Yeah. Which is, well, and I feel too, it kind of depends on what era you're talking about.
Really?
A little bit.
Okay.
You know, I mean,
like Bill's always just doing whatever the fuck he wants to do back there. Right. Mickey is hammering some weird shit probably out of time. You know, Phil is, you know, like he's dancing around it. You know, he's a string section. He's not bass. You know, he's the cellos and the fucking violas. You know, he's making his statement known, you know?
Sure.
Bob is ducking and weaving and fucking coming out, jabbing you here and there, you know? And then obviously you got the fucking other guy out there doing his thing, you know? You know, like that's a very like, we're all coming at you type of thing, you know? Whereas an electronic music is more of like a, there's like a film over it. You know, it's like, it's this one thing. It's a mood. You're listening to a mood. You're not listening to players or individuals or even individual instruments. You're listening to a mood.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. And I guess, yeah, we kind of got started on that vibe of the whole around sort of that electronic stuff. But I do, you know, it's like, I feel like when, especially when you go back and you hear them, you know, I remember so interesting for me reading in Phil's book about sort of when he thought, you know, it was like by the mid to late 70s, in some way, a part of that band had already kind of run its course.
Yeah.
And I think that's when they started to move more in this direction, like you say. And I agree, you know, there's a lot of very distinct personalities all pushing the envelope in their own little sphere.
Yeah.
But, you know, for a lot of the stuff that I love, especially when they get out, you know, and it's fun to like play the gnarly Grateful Dead jams from the early days, you know, it was this moment in time of listening and togetherness that, you know, maybe the music didn't always represent, but,
the end result was the same
okay.
as what we're talking about. But how they went about it was like, definitely just like, hey man, we're all fucking hammering this.
Yeah. In terms of like how they produced, structured, viewed their own music. Okay.
But anyway, so back to the whole thing, which was like, so I got into this electronic music bullshit, and it just humbled me, man, and it made me put that get a lot of perspective and like really learn that the ego is it's fucking toxic, man. It doesn't, you know. I mean, a lot of LSD helped too, I'm sure. Like, but, you know, it's like, it is. It's a toxic thing, man. You know, it's like, it doesn't matter. You know, there's nothing worse than being in a room when you're, like, mixing something and then, like, you know, the drummer wants the drums louder and the bass player wants the bass louder and the keyboard player wants the keyboard. You know, you're just like,
yeah,
fucking shut up.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's not about you.
Yeah.
Be selfless. You know, like, this art is, you know, it's art.
Yeah.
You know, you're doing it because it's cathartic for yourself. And if you're really lucky, it's cathartic for somebody else, you know, and it's for them, you know, like get yourself out of the fucking way.
Yeah.
Like, you know, let that connection happen.
I get it. And I hear that.
So convincing people that while you're producing.
Okay.
Is the thing, you know, so like with like the Ghostlight thing, you know, like that band, we had never been in a room together until
Hit the studio in Philly.
Until day one of if hitting record, you know, the five of us had never been in a room.
Now, had you guys shared songs leading into that, or was it like come together and this is the real advent moment?
No, it was, I inched everybody into it. Like, so Rain and I wrote everything, or not everything. We wrote a lot of stuff together. Yeah. We still live together, I have a house in Philly. So I have like a small studio at home. So we would just like eat acid and write for fucking however long that lasts, you know, 8 hours, 10 hours. And we would just record the whole thing. So it's just like 8 hours of just nonsense.
Your own little personal acid test.
Yeah, for sure. We did that, you know, once or twice a week for 3 months, I guess, you know, and
this is a precursor to Ghostlight.
Yeah, this was, okay. So let's just do the Ghostlight story. So I was doing American Babies, and J-Rad, and I had a band with Bob and Bill.
Billy and the Kids?
No.
Oh, no.
Los Muertos.
Okay, that's right.
It was me and Bob, Bill, Dave Schools, and Jeff Cementi. And it was the shit. great band, dude. Such a good band. So I'm in Mexico. We're playing this festival. And, you know, I'm in a band with Bob fucking Weir and Bill goddamn Kreutzmann, you know. And J-Rad is fucking killing it at this point. You know, my life has been completely transformed over the last 2 years. And I was miserable. I was fucking miserable.
Why?
I just wasn't fulfilled.
Okay.
You know, and my my manager was just like, dude, you're on a beach in a private resort in Mexico. You got your girlfriend and your brother and your, you know, my manager was a good friend of mine. And he's like, you know, you're in a band with fucking the Grateful Dead, basically, and you're fucking miserable. You need to figure it the fuck out, man. You know, so, I was like, yeah, you know what? I'm just going to fucking blow up the American Babies thing and start over.
So you were essentially unfulfilled by the music. It wasn't...
Well, I mean, like, dude, I love playing... I mean, I love the Dead thing and all that stuff, but that's not my... You know, those aren't my songs. I didn't earn those songs. You know, like, I look at that stuff, playing with those guys or the J-Rad thing, I owe them. You know, I owe that music. I owe those songs, man. Like, that stuff made me who I was throughout my entire life and has given me what I have now. I will serve that music as long as it wants me to serve it, you know? But I have no illusions that that shit is mine. I have no ownership of that music. That is, I did not, that does not belong to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, there, I definitely have met fucking people that play that music that think they're the fucking Grateful Dead. And it's like, no, dude, you're not, man. You know, like, those dudes gave everything for us and for those songs, you know? I came in at the finish line. I was just like, I'll take it from here, boys. You know what I mean? Like, that's, you know, and like, super lucky, but like, I would never ever think or act in a way where like I have pride in that music in the way that it's mine. You know, like,
I get it.
That is, you know, I work for that music. That's, you know, that is not that. I need to have my own outlet. I need to have my own outlet of original music, shit that I write, that I, you know, that I create, my catalog that, you know, when I'm hopefully fucking Bob's age, you know, I'm still playing and that people give a fuck about, you know? And that wasn't really a thing that was happening. You know, like I wanted a band, you know, American Babies was supposed to be a band when it started, you know, it was me and Russo and my brother, the touring band had Metzger was in it. Drywitz was in it sometimes. I mean, it was basically J-Rad, you know, mm-hmm, for a mm-hmm. while. But then Joe got the further gig, you know, so he was out, you know, my brother was in the military. He went to Afghanistan. He was out, you know? So then then it just turned into like a solo project, and every album I would basically write and record most of the record by myself and then put a band together and then tour it, you know? And then every album I would flip the band pretty much, you know? That's not my thing, you know? As we were talking about earlier, like I'm into a being egoless. I don't want it to be the Tom Hamilton show. I want it to be a band. I want it to be a thing that's greater than myself. And I didn't have that and it made me fucking miserable. So, you know, we were at the end of an American Babies album cycle, and it was like, all right, I'm going to have to I'm going to have to either put together a new band and keep calling it American Babies and keep doing this fucking thing, or I could just start a new fucking band, you know? So Rain and I, you know, I talked to her about it, and I was like, you know, are you down to keep doing this and working together? And, you know, she was in, and I just kind of, yeah, I was like, all right, Holly had been sitting in with us with American Babies here and there, and mm-hmm. we all got along. She and I have a very great, very good chemistry as far as like how we improvise. And
great to see her, like, her whole story is so interesting.
Yeah,
but just to
in
get,
a band,
have an outlet,
not playing
exactly.
fucking Fish songs, you know, yeah. like.
And killing it.
Yeah.
She sounds incredible.
Absolutely, you know. And, you know, so and that was the thing. It was like, okay, like, you know, like she's an incredible talent. She should be doing more than playing fucking covers. And, you know, and I loved hanging out with her. So I was like, all right, well, let's see if she'll fucking, you know, let's see if she'll want to do this. And then, you know, Scotty's Wang, I knew didn't have a gig, and he was, he had recently moved to Philadelphia, which was pretty synergistic. And the original bass player, this guy, Steve Lyons, he's like one of my favorite musicians I've ever known. This guy's a monster. just monster fucking, I mean, in general, musician. He can play everything very well, you know, and he's a great producer. And he had just moved back to Philadelphia, you know, or no, he was in LA, but he was in Philly when I like thought of him anyway. And, so yeah, just kind of like put the whole thing together and convinced them all to be in this band. And it was just like, look, I want to do this band. I have this manager. I'm going to go after, you know, these people as far as like our, you know, our team. And this was probably in like the summer, you know, it was like June or something. I was like, you know, I don't have any music, but it'll be good. You know, trust me, because you know, all these people knew, they've heard my songs. They've played my songs. They mm-hmm. like my songs. It's like, look, I'm not going to all of a sudden start writing shitty music. You know, like that's going to be okay. And you know, with what I had with J-Rad and the opportunity that it gave me, it's like, I'm going to use that to help this project go where it wants to go. You know, I mean, like, fortunately I had a little more clout because all of a sudden, you know, I'm doing all this cool shit.
Well, that's an interesting part of it, because you know, you guys have a really interesting story. I mean, you've come out of the gates really hot. A lot of people already know who you are, because I think a lot of you guys have already made a name for yourselves as individuals in some way, and you're sort of on the map, and there's this vision, this energy that you're describing, the desire to really create that band synergy. And I mean, you guys have only been a band for
2 years.
2 years.
Yeah. And our first show was like the middle of April of 2018, you know. But, you know, and that would, I mean, that was the whole thing. It was like, look, man, trust me. We're going to write some great tunes. And so if everybody agrees, we're going to meet in the studio the week after Thanksgiving. You know, so it gave us like 4 months, basically. And I had no songs. I had nothing, you know. And I gave that same pitch to a manager. I gave that same pitch to our agent. And they bit for some reason. You know, it was like, look, I have an idea for a band. I don't have any songs, but it's going to be good. So yeah, so Raina and I locked ourselves in our house for fucking a few months. And for me, it's like, look, man, this was going to be my third band. It's hard to have one band ever. Having a second one that doesn't sound like your first one is also difficult. Mm-hmm. You know, American Babies and Brothers Past, fortunately, were very different bands. Stepping up to the plate for a third time, I was just like, it was a daunting proposition. It's like, well, how the fuck am I going to have another band that doesn't sound like the other two, you know?
Not to mention to get another project off the ground is...
And not have it just fucking, you know, drop on the, after the first step, you know?
Because it doesn't matter. I mean, of course, it does matter how good you are, but you still got to put in the time.
Yeah.
And you still got to get out there
and
tour in this, you know, sort of music industry climate. Yeah,
there's no replacement for that, you know? So I was kind of trying to figure out how to do something different and get out of my own head. Raina is significantly younger and hadn't really experimented very much with psychedelics. So it was like, and I hadn't eaten acid in 18 years. So I was like, well, you know what, man, I think if there's ever a reason to try to reshuffle the deck, this is it, you know? So yeah. So we got in the studio and we tripped a bunch. We wrote probably 14 or 15 pieces of tunes, you know,
leading into the sessions.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Like, so we had, you know, that much. And then, you know, then Scotty moved to Philly and, you know, like, hey man, you want to come over and kind of like fuck around with a couple of these ideas. And then that kind of started to get some of the songs in shape and whittle down the list. You know, it's like, okay, maybe not 15, let's get it down to 12. And then it was, you know, and then Steve came back to Philly. He was living in LA. He came back to Philly for like, I think actually we might've just flown him out just to hang, you know? And I was like, hey man, come and like, see what you can do with some of these tunes, you know? And so some more ideas, and that kind of just like gave me a better idea of like what songs work and what don't, you know? And then Holly and I had met up and, you know, she played me some of the ideas that she had, and we kind of went through those things. So by the time we got into the studio, there was, you know, 11 or 12 songs that we were like, okay, this is what we're going to work on, you know? And I think the slow build process into, you know, leading into going to the studio, I think people, I gave people a reason to trust me. You know, I was like, look at where we're at. Look at these songs, where these songs are right now. This is all quality material.
Yeah.
You know?
It doesn't sound like a first record. It sounds like,
well, it's my fucking ninth or whatever. You know,
right.
I mean, there's
interesting.
You know, I mean, like,
way
you
to
know,
look at that. Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, that's reality.
That is. Yeah.
And that's a challenge. That's a real fucking challenge, on my part, because Rain has never made a full length record. Holly's never been in a original band situation at all. You know, Scotty's been in and out and around, but you know, he's not a writer necessarily at all. You know, Scott's an incredible talent and a great member of a band, you know, but not a lot of writing or record making experience, you know.
Yeah.
Steve, was a, like I said, he was a great talent and a very good producer. So he was on where I was at, but you know, there's a lot of mistakes people make with like their first, you know, your first records sometimes are dog shit unless you have a great team or unless you're fucking, you know, Pearl Jam.
Yeah. Know? And I think a lot of bands, you know, before they ever get into the studio, you know, they play,
right.
They play a lot.
There's a whole list of shit that usually happens and like pitfalls that bands are going to go through when they first become a band. Right. Yep. You know, at the time, I was 38 years old and I'm not doing that. You know, I'm not redoing all these lessons I've already fucking learned twice, yeah. You know, with Brothers Past and with American Babies. I know the things to avoid, you know,
yeah.
And like, and the cliches to avoid. Which
and
is,
you probably also had a good handle on sort of the next step of things, which is taking these tunes out and playing them live, you know, which is another
whole other thing.
Yeah. And so you guys, the band is sort of born in the studio.
Yeah.
And then you got to go learn how to play these things on stage. And
well, you know, that was the part I was the least concerned about, you know, because Scotty's was, you know, he was in Dopapod. He's a, you know, he's a jammer, you know, mm-hmm. He's in the scene. Holly, obviously, you know, Steve was, was also just a fucking virtuoso as far as just improvising and all that stuff. And Rain and I had been playing together for 3 years. So,
yeah.
You know, we already had a chemistry. So like, as far as like the live thing, I wasn't worried about that at all. I was like, no, this is going to be a fucking powerhouse when it comes to that shit. But there's the thing of, you put five swinging dicks in a room, if no one knows how to fucking write a song, it doesn't matter, mm-hmm. Right? So I didn't want it to be that. And that was, so it was like, you know, every once in a while we would like open it up in the studio just to like, just kind of stretch our legs and make sure that we can do it. But the focus was on the songs, because it's like, look, man, this is not going to be a jam band.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, hey, well, yeah, we just got in a room, just do it together, and we have a song about fucking dragons or whatever. Like,
is that what jam bands?
I mean, I don't know, but you know what I mean. Just like, it's not gonna. There's not. This is not gonna be a thing where there's throwaway songs. There were vehicles for jams. It's like, this is, we're gonna be a fucking band that improvises, not an improvising band. You
yeah.
know what I mean? Like, there's a fucking difference.
Well, and I feel like probably a lot of that has to do with you as a producer and seeing the big picture,
right.
And understanding, you know, all these things that we've been talking about. But the record is such a success in terms of combining a pretty disparate, you know, group of elements, and that I love.
Yeah,
you know,
it casts a wide net.
It casts a wide net, and it, you know, you guys are a rock band one minute, you know, next minute you're sort of this ambient sound, you know, really stripped down, super dynamic. The instrumentation is really cool and unique. And I remember when we were up at the Borderlands Festival in upstate New York,
like Buffalo or something. Right?
Yeah. We were getting ready to go on stage. We did a set with O'Teal and Keller.
Yeah.
And this band is like raging, and we're like, "What? Who is that?" Ghostlight.
Yes.
You know, and it was interesting to go then, because I hadn't really checked out the record at that point.
Yeah.
And then to dig into the record, and man, it's like, you know, the dynamic, you know, range is from 0.01 to like 10 out of 10.
Yeah.
And you know, it wasn't necessarily what I was expecting, having heard you guys live. And granted, I didn't get to take in the whole show, but it was like, man, this thing is rocking.
Yeah.
You know, really really translating really well, and it was really cool in that live environment.
Dude, well, you know, and it comes back to, you know, it always comes back to the Dead in some way, I guess, you know, but like the thing that was, that really drove me in the mission statement of putting the band together was like, you know, you have ideas about like what people think or how they are when you're listening to bands or whatever, you know, and then, you know, but like getting to know the dudes in the Dead and to play with them, and realizing that like, yeah, man, the fucking song, that is still,
that's the thing,
the most important thing. And yeah, it always was to those guys. It was about the songs, man. If the song isn't there, none of the other shit matters, you know? And like,
and even to take that a step further, you know, if you think about artists that stand the test of time, there's only one reason that happens.
Yeah.
And that's songs. And
100%.
It's interesting to think about that in today's music climate, because, you know, you've got electronic music raging, you know, you've got sort of the whole decline of the recording industry. Yeah. So like some people these days are like, should I even make an album?
Yeah.
You know, but all of that stuff is going, I think, to sort of fade as a trend, and it will always circle back to the songs, and that's what's going to make artists relevant over a long period of time.
Buddy, I hope you're right. You know, a friend of mine's band, they're a great band, a popular band, you know, and I was hanging out with one of the dudes the other day, and I was just, you know, talking about like, oh, you guys going to make a new record or whatever. He's like, you know, the primary songwriters, they don't really think it matters anymore
to make an album.
Yeah,
song.
To write
like,
new songs.
Like, it still matters to record music, but
they just don't care. They're just like, you know what? People are coming to our shows. They want to hear what, you know, shit from our four previous records. They're just jaded, you know?
So they've got a catalog, and because of the way things are with streaming, et cetera.
And how just disposable it all is.
Okay, but do you doubt that? I mean, do you doubt the fact that—
I don't care. I don't give a fuck. You know, like, I think it's not a choice. I don't get to pick that. That's not a thing. I don't get to say, I don't want to do that. Like, I have to do that. It's a vocation. It was never, I never thought I would make a fucking penny from playing music. It wasn't about that. That's not, who cares?
Yeah.
It's about creating something that wasn't there before, you know, and that's always been the fucking thing. You know, I'm very fortunate to have the life I have now, but you know, 5 years ago, dude, I was a fucking plumber who couldn't pay my rent. And I was fine with it, you know, because I was playing music. I was still writing records and putting myself in debt just to make an album, you know, like, because I had to do it.
Yep.
You know, like, that's the thing, you know.
Well,
it's not a business decision.
No, but I think personally, I believe really strongly that it's all going to circle back around, because, you know, and if you look at, like, for example, you know, as people get older, their tastes change. Sure. And music these days is a sort of this wide swath of the live experience and all these different, you know, interactive ways that bands are engaging their fans, because, you know, you don't necessarily make a lot of money off your albums these days. So you got to figure out how to monetize this attention.
Sure.
But down the line, you know, I think, and there's just a lot of good proof to it already, you know, Bruce Springsteen, Neil Young,
the Stones.
This is the stuff that people will always be listening to. You know, the Beatles are never going out of style, you know? And so.
Isn't that amazing?
It is. It is.
Did you
I come back to it myself, you know.
Did you see the Hard Day's Night, or is that what it's called? Or no, 8 Days a Week. It was the Ron Howard documentary.
It was about
the touring years.
Yeah.
It stopped at Sgt. Pepper.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, I watched that thing and it made me realize, well, A, that was the first time anybody really fully explained just how popular that band was.
Yeah.
Like, there's never been anything like that, like,
right,
even close.
Yeah. 6 years.
That's it.
I mean,
yeah.
I mean, it took us 6 years to see if we even had a room full of fans.
Yeah.
And it's like that for most bands out there these days.
Well, now, yeah.
Yeah.
But, dude, we're all just chasing that. There's an entire industry that all they're doing is chasing the success of the Beatles. That's it. That's all we're all doing is trying to affect the world like they did.
Yeah.
You know, like that's crazy. You know what I mean? Like those, what they did is so untouchable. You know what I mean? They're the Wayne Gretzky of fucking, you know, it's like, it's just like they're just the best. And like, you know, I don't know. Sometimes that's sometimes where I think about like fucking packing it in. Or like I listen to like, yeah, I'll just listen to fucking Beatles records. And I'm just like, what's the fucking point?
I've been coming back to Revolver a lot.
Man,
it's just epic.
Fucking,
I mean, they're all, I have periods where one sort of filters to the top.
Yeah, exactly. But a lot of the early shit, man, you know, like just like Meet the Beatles.
Yeah.
Just, oh my God. Fuck. Know. You know, like
I saw the Ron Howard doc and I knew sort of the timeline and how things laid out, but so crazy, like when they're playing in Mets Shea Stadium in New York and the sound is literally broadcasting over the PA address, you know, so instead of, you know, now batting, you know, number five, it's like the Beatles coming out
through this dog shit.
Oh, it's so bad. System. And you hear the guys talk about it. And meanwhile, you know, so they were ahead of their time in terms of basically everything, but in terms of performing on that large scale, you know, and then that's done and they just continue to crank out
the best shit ever
records. Yeah.
Just the best shit ever, you know, like, it's really, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, fuck.
Yeah.
Why does anybody bother, you know, after that, you know, it's like their perfection has been reached.
Now I gotta ask before we wrap up just a little bit about J-Rad. I'm so curious.
I don't need to wrap up. I'll talk as long as you want to go.
This is great, man. I love hearing your perspective on all this stuff, especially after having listened to the music so much, you know, because I hear all that and, you know, Ghostlight and a real success of production in terms of bringing all this stuff together. But I think, you know, the J-Rad thing is so interesting, and I've always been curious, you know, when you guys set out to do this thing.
We didn't.
What? Yeah, okay, so I was going to ask, what did you think was,
there, we didn't,
was the end game?
We didn't.
So how
there
did
was
it,
no end game.
So you just got together to play.
Joe was in Further with Bob and Phil.
Sure.
And he had joked about, you know, I mean, so all the crew, the J-Rad guys, I was the only person that like liked the Dead prior to J-Rad. You know, like Marco and Scott and Dave. I mean, you know, they all knew who the Dead were, but they didn't like, they weren't fans. You know, they weren't Deadheads. You know, I grew up on this shit. I mean,
okay.
I've been doing what I'm doing in J-Rad since I was 12, like in bars with my brother, you know, like it's just, you know, so like Joe and I would always talk about the, you know, the music and stuff like that. You know, I mean, like when he got the gig and he dove into the catalog, he was just like, dude, I can't believe how good this shit is. You know? And it was, you know, he really loves
it. Welcome to the club.
Yeah. I mean, he just loves it. And it was, you know, it was great. And we were able to talk about it. And, so like, you know, we definitely would joke about like, dude, we should do a gig sometime where we play, you know, play that music. Which he was always kind of just like, you know, like whatever. You know, he's just like smart like that and like deliberate, you know. There's a thing, the New York Freaks, it's like a group of music fans in New York, and they put together this weekend of concerts every year at Brooklyn Bowl called the Freaks Ball. Somebody was supposed to headline one of the nights and they had to cancel. And they reached out to Joe and were like, hey, man, you know, his Led Zeppelin thing, Bustle in Your Hedgerow, which is everybody in J-Rad except me. They were already playing, I think, the Friday night. And so somebody reached out to Joe and was just like, hey, dude, do you want to put together something for the Saturday? And, you know, it was like, I don't know. So then, you know, we talked about, you know, he's like, hey, should we do a Dead thing? And we, it was like, all right, well, you know, who do we get? And we started talking about like all these people, and it was just like, you know, and Joe was just like, I'll just get all the Bustle guys because, like, you know, like they're awesome, and he, you know, like there's already a relationship there. And it was, but it was like a joke, you know what I mean? It was like he just wanted to play these tunes with the energy and just the way he wanted to do it. You know, he didn't want to play the songs, you know, just to try doing it a different way, like not doing it the the way Bob or Phil wanted it to be done. And it was a one-time thing that was...
no, it wasn't.
And even the one time, we were just like, just laughing. We're like, I can't believe we're doing this. Like, this is fucking ridiculous. But we did the show, and when we walked off stage, looked at each other like, what the fuck was that? I mean, it was like a real moment of like, holy shit. And then we listened to it, and I was like, wow, that was actually pretty good. But it didn't, but that's not, you know, Joe had further. So there was, you know, he's like, well, I can't, you know, I'm not going to go play.
He was basically in the new
Grateful. I'm not going to go play that music with somebody else, you know? And also nobody had any fucking interest in it. You know, I mean, like I was doing American Babies and I'm sure other shit, you know, Marco has his trio. Scott was doing whatever. I mean, Scott's a fucking all in, super high in demand fucking session guy in New York. Dave's in Ween. You know, we all had our own shit, mm-hmm. and it was just like, you know, whatever. But people kind of freaked the fuck out, and that was in January. And then that whole year, we just said no
to a bunch of offers.
Yeah, we're just like, no, we're not a band. What the fuck do you want from us? Like, we're not, you know, this doesn't exist,
right? And was some of that like conflict about doing a cover thing exclusively?
That's not what any of us want to do.
Right.
You know, it's not a real thing, you know?
So how long was it before you guys actually got back?
It was a year.
A year, okay.
Pretty much. You know, it was the first show was in January, and then the next show was in December.
And that was like 2013 or 13, 14.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
But so the guy that owns the Bowl also owns the Cap, Pete Shapiro.
Shapiro, yeah.
And he was like, do one more show, but do it at the Cap. And we're just like, no, we're not doing a fucking, we're not doing a Grateful Dead cover band show in a fucking 2,000 seat theater. That's stupid and suicide. Nobody's going to fucking show up. And we were wrong.
Yeah, you were.
People showed up.
How was that? Did that show sell out?
Yeah. And
on what grounds? Like, how did people know that you guys?
The recordings of that one show
circulated.
People lost their fucking minds.
Yeah.
You know?
It's crazy to see the rising tide of the Grateful Dead's influence these last few years. I mean, the Grateful Dead have always been obviously sort of the juggernaut, you know.
But there was a huge lull for a while.
But now, these past few years,
it's back.
I mean, it's crazy.
I think since GD50, it's been, you know, like, but, you know, so, I mean, at the time, and then I think, so by the time we did that second show, the writing was on the wall that Further was ending.
And that kind of opened the door.
Well, you know, it just was kind of like Further was ending, and these songs, you know, Joe believes in that catalog, you know, and really, I mean, that's a part of him, you know, I would say. And that's as far as I'll go, as far as speculating on what he thinks, but like, it's also a part of me. You know, I love that stuff. You know what I mean?
And if we're talking about songs.
Yeah. I mean, like there's
archetypal,
nothing,
legendary, covering all
the great American song.
That's right.
You know, I mean, it's the soundtrack to a fucking Kerouac.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like
it's interesting because I wasn't necessarily raised on it. I mean, they had always crossed my radar just because how can they not?
Sure. Yeah.
And, you know, String Dusters have been touring for about 14 years now. But as this recent, like I was saying, sort of rising tide of the influence. I think you're right. GD50, you know, was sort of a signifier in that timeline. But we started doing Keller Williams' Grateful Grass, and that's actually what that's what that O'Teal Keller show was at Borderlands. Now it's like everybody knows how to play every Grateful Dead song, and those songs are fucking hard to play.
Yeah, no, it's the new real book.
That's right.
You know,
it is
it's you know, the real book for songs.
Yeah,
you know, that's
when strangers crazy. Come together and play Terrapin, you're just like, what's going on here? Yeah. That's not like that
everybody,
wasn't
everybody's just nailing it.
Yeah, it's like that right, wasn't meant to be, but
that's pretty crazy. You know,
but it again, I think, you know, talk about legendary songs, sort of solidifying a band as standing the test of time, and then also the reality that, you know, every band has, and this is gets back to everything you were saying about the whole and the absence, you know, every band at some point that, you know, really comes together and makes something significant is putting forth their ethos, their philosophy,
yeah.
You know, and that part of it, you know, just the community vibe, you know, you could see it at GD50 and it was like,
it was amazing.
People were looking, you know, this is a good thing. Let's find the right forum to be a part of this amazing music again. And you guys have been such a huge part of kind of keeping that flame burning.
It's, you know, well, like I was saying earlier, you know, it's like, you know, serving the music, not the other way around, you know, like it's, I think these songs are really important, man. And like, and the attitude behind them is also really important. You know, like I was saying with the dead guys, like there is ego in that band.
Oh, yeah.
There is like swinging dicks. Like this is, we're coming at you. We're doing this thing. We are going to rip your fucking face off and we're going to make you feel more than you are comfortable feeling, you know? And I think when you take that and you run with it in a very pure way, you know, like I think the reason that people like J-Rad is because we're not trying to sound like the dead. We don't sound like the Grateful Dead. If you are expecting that, you're going to be disappointed, you know, like people definitely talk shit like that, you know, like, well, they don't do it for me like the dead did. Well, no shit. There's already the Grateful Dead. We are not trying to do that. No one would ever begin to say anything that has to do with us being on par with the Grateful Dead. There's already a Grateful Dead.
Yeah.
You know, like let them be that thing. They are that thing. We're just trying to keep the songs alive and relevant in a way that is looking ahead of you, not looking behind you, you know,
sure.
Like, you know, they're like, yeah, you know, like Dark Star Orchestra. I mean, they're a great band. What they do is cool, but that what they do is firmly in a rearview mirror, you know,
trying to sound like the Grateful Dead.
Well, it's nostalgia and that's awesome. And that's cool. That serves a purpose. I'm sure those guys are fine people, but like, you know, we go up there and we use those songs as a platform to do what the five of us can do. And you know, between all of us, we've known each other for 20 years. You know, there's a lot of history there. And it doesn't have to be the Grateful Dead's music. You know, we do it with any song, you know,
yeah.
And like, but you know, but taking those songs and using them to take real risks,
mm-hmm.
And you know, like, you know, I people don't, there's not a lot of bands that really improvise anymore, you know, that like are going out there with no fucking safety net,
yep.
With no plan, you know, with no microphone that talks to each other. That's like, hey, go to A. Like, you know what I mean? Like that's not fucking improvising,
yeah.
You know, like be in the moment, be on that stage, be looking at your bandmates, be, you know, like communicating.
Yeah. And improvising as a group.
Writing songs on the spot. But,
yeah.
You know, not like, hey, man, you're going to solo for 45 minutes no. And then I'm going to solo for 45 minutes. Then we're going to pass it to that fucking guy. Then that. No, like creating new things, you know, that like where you're listening, where you can put something on in the middle of a jam and be like, I don't know what song this is, where it came from or what it's going. This is its own thing. And it's a beautiful moment. And then it'll fucking work its way into something. And you're like, oh, shit. How did we get from there to here? You know, and that's improvising. That's what people loved about that, the improvising aspect of bands like The Dead or Fish. You know, like those guys used to really go for some shit.
Right. And it's not just, you know, one guy improvising.
Right.
And people don't. And that's the magic of a band. You know, I think when people think of improvising, they think of playing a solo.
Right.
You know, and with every successive person that, you know, if you got just two guys playing music together, it's like the music could go anywhere, anytime.
Yeah.
Add third, fourth person to that mix, you know, things get a little bit more complicated. But
yeah, in theory, it's less malleable.
Exactly.
You know, there's five people on stage.
But they just sort of blew that whole convention out the window and did it just by committing,
yeah.
You know, and you can hear it in a lot of the
willing participants.
And I love that. And that's what, you know, and they did that. They learned how to do that in a live environment. And that's, I agree, you know, there's a lot of different conceptions of what improvising is, but when you bring, you know, there's like five of us on stage, and that's been my main playing experience. And when you bring everyone to that fold and everyone's improvising together,
yeah.
It's not just about a solo. That's when some real money shit goes down.
Exactly. And it's that the greater good, you know, what does this thing right now need? You know, and if what it needs is no fucking guitar, then shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
And just let the rest of the guys carry the load for a little
bit.
That's
right.
You know, like, it's okay to, I mean, it's the, you're playing a ballad, right? It's super quiet. You're in a real low moment. And then there's one dickhead in the crowd that's like, woo, right? Why? Because that guy was so scared of the vulnerability that he was feeling and the silence and what that does. Don't be afraid to be nothing. Don't be afraid to be silent and to just not fucking exist for a minute. Mm-hmm. Don't be afraid to not have that spotlight on you.
Great.
It's
great,
okay.
Yeah.
You know?
Great advice on music and life in general.
From
Tom Hamilton. Man.
Write it down.
Thank you. Thank you so much for doing
this
today,
man. Fucking
this,
pleasure, man.
This has been awesome.
I hope it was okay. This is,
best of luck with everything you're going on, man. You got a lot of irons in the fire, and the Ghostlight record is tremendous. And, you know, I'm a fan, so I look forward to seeing where everything goes, man.
Cool.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yep. That's a wrap on episode 10 and also the first season of Inside the Musician's Brain. Thank you all so much for tuning in. Huge thanks to all my great guests this season. Thanks to EMG for helping me get this episode out there today. And also to everyone at Osiris Media for helping me make it happen here at Inside the Musician's Brain. Head over to Apple Podcasts, leave us a review, and please pay me a visit anytime on Instagram or also on the Dusters fan page on Facebook. That's Got Dusted. Let me know what you guys are into hearing about, into learning about, and I'll do my best to cover all that in season 2. Make sure to check out our playlist on Spotify. That's Inside the Musician's Brain, and I'll be adding cool stuff to that while I'm off the airwaves for a minute, regrouping and getting ready for the next season of heady music listening here on Inside the Musician's Brain. I'm Chris Pandolfi, signing off for now. Thank you so much for listening.
Yes, we're out there, everyone. I'm Hal Schwartz.
And I'm Flynn McClain. Together, we host None But the Brave, a podcast dedicated to the music and career of Bruce Springsteen.
Bruce and E Street Band are on tour right now for the first time in 6 years, and we're taking a detailed look at what's happening on stage in our bi-weekly episodes.
We've also been recently joined by some very exciting guests, including rock journalist Warren Zanes and Stephen Hyden, Backstreet's Magazine founder Charles Cross, and Barstool's Kirk Menahan.
If you're a diehard Springsteen fan, this is the show for you.
So please subscribe to None But the Brave on your favorite podcasting platform, and we hope to see you further on up the road.
Thank you so much! We'll be seeing you!